lying half in the hall, half in the living room, so Giller could only see his feet, one of which was still twitching. Tanya was slumped against the wall, her legs outstretched before her. The bullet had taken her in the chest, killing her instantly. Pallida Moores was standing over the woman's body, as though puzzled by the alteration wrought upon it by mortality, a pale ghost with a new house to haunt. Her hair was entirely concealed by the blue plastic skullcap, rendering her appearance stranger still. A pistol, deformed by a suppressor, hung at her side, exhaling a final wisp of smoke. Giller had never heard a suppressed shot fired before. He was surprised at how loud it sounded. Not like a little cough, but an angry bark. As Giller watched, Moores knelt and placed the palm of her left hand on Tanya's womb. She kept it there as she turned to Giller.
"I can feel it kicking,"
she said. Giller said nothing. He had wandered into hell, and now one of its demons was speaking to him in a language he did not wish to understand. He put his hands over his ears and closed his eyes, but could still hear what Moores said next.
"It's stopped now."
Footsteps drew nearer, and with them the stink of Moores, potent even amid the gun smoke, the blood, and the smell of dying. She was its quintessence, the crux of it made manifest. It was in her name. She was death itself. And Giller understood that every moment of his being, from the fusion of seed and egg in a distant congress, through pain and joy and love and loss, to the final clarity of this last poor province, a realm of splintered wood and stinking food, had been leading to just this instant. And so he was defined by what he had caused to be committed here, and the little good he had done in life would be swept away like ash from the final conflagration of his existence.
"Look at me,"
said Moores. Giller opened his eyes and was named by the gun. Chapter 90. Parker, Hillock, and Shears decided between them that it would be better if Parker spoke with Layla Patton alone. Hillock was of the opinion that any effort to intimidate the young woman was likely to fail, and the depth of the failure would be commensurate with the degree of intimidation involved. In other words, Patton would be three times as stubborn if faced with all of them. Parker was standing by his rental when Patton finally emerged at the end of her waitressing shift, still wearing the clothes in which he'd worked. He was parked far enough away so as not to risk alarming her, but close enough that she couldn't get to her car and drive off before he could speak with her. "Miss Patton?" She stopped by her vehicle, and he noticed that she immediately slipped a key between the middle and ring fingers of her right hand before clenching a fist. Clearly, she wasn't about to be taken by surprise again. She squinted at Parker, the sun behind him.
"You were in the diner earlier," she said. "Who are you, and what do you want?"
Parker stopped just out of striking range. "My name is Charlie Parker. We spoke on the telephone, but didn't get very far. I thought I'd try a conversation in person." She didn't relax, but she shifted the key in her hand to open her car door.
"I told you, I have nothing to say."
"People are dying, Layla, and not just here. I think whoever killed Dobie and Esther murdered a woman in Maine and dumped her body at a quarry. I think they're going to keep on killing until they get what they want." Patton stopped, the key in the lock, and turned to face him.
"Esther's missing, not dead. Dobie died in a fire."
"I don't think you believe that for one moment. Just as you don't believe Dobie killed himself through carelessness with a joint."
"I don't know what I believe."
He had her now. He could hear it in her voice. "But you cared about both of them."
"Yes."
"Then I'd like to talk to you about them for a few minutes. You may know more than you think."
"I have to get back to my mom. She's sick."
Parker just listened. Anything he said wouldn't have helped. He waited and watched the fight go out of Layla Patton. She silently took in the parking lot, the diner, and the town of Cadillac itself, as though wondering how, or if, she might ever escape them all.
"If it's true," she said at last, "about these people, whoever they are, then you're going to stop them?"
"Yes."
"Isn't that what the police are supposed to do?"
"Sometimes I do it better." She sized Parker up and still appeared to find him wanting. He didn't take it personally.
"Alone?"
she asked. "I have help if I need it."
"And have you needed it in the past?"
"Occasionally."
"I suppose I could have Googled you," she said. "But I've grown to hate that kind of thing. It's creepy."
"Agreed."
"If I had searched, would I have liked what I found?"
She was facing him now, and he felt certain that she had something to tell. He could see it in her eyes. "I hope so. Not all of it, maybe, but most. Even I don't care for all I've done." When she spoke again, her voice was so soft that the breeze almost scattered her words before Parker could catch them.
"I'm afraid she'll come back."
"Who?"
"The woman who tried to hurt me."
"Did she say she would?"
"She didn't say anything at all."
"And yet?" Patton's nose wrinkled, like a small mammal sniffing for the presence of a larger carnivore.
"She smelled bad. Not like she didn't bathe enough, but bad from the inside. You probably don't know what I mean. I'm not explaining it very well."
Parker stepped closer. "You wake in the night," he said, "and you can still smell it, as though she's there in the room with you. When you're low or scared, you taste it in your food. You catch traces of it from spoiled milk, from open drains, from roadkill."
"Yes,"
she said.
"That's it. Does it go away?"
"No, not if you've been touched by it. It stays."
"So what do you do?"
"You hope for the removal of its source from the world and live with the memory." He smiled at her. "How about this? If you give me some of your time, I'll talk. I'll tell you about myself and how I know these things. When I'm done, if you don't trust me, I'll leave and I won't trouble you again. I'll catch a flight back east and find another way to stop what's happening. I won't involve you in it, but..." He didn't finish.
"But I'm already involved, right?"
said Patton.
"That's what you were going to say?"
"Yes."
"And that woman will come back, won't she?"
"It's possible. Either you're a loose end, in which case she'll return because she has to, or she enjoys what she does, and she'll return because she wants to. For those like her, the ones corrupted deep down, it's usually more the second than the first."
"You could have said that earlier. You could have used the threat to make me change my mind."
"I'm not here to threaten you. And I didn't have to change your mind. You already knew the right thing to do. You just needed someone to confirm it for you. And you're not doing this for yourself. I don't think that's the kind of person you are. You'll do it because it'll save others. But there's nothing wrong with saving yourself along the way."
"That's quite a speech."
"I get a lot of practice."
"I guess you must."
She opened her car door.
"Follow me."
Chapter 91. Owen Weber sat with his grandson on the living room couch, watching a cartoon custom-tooled to sell toys to kids and thus wring maximum profit from minimal entertainment. Daniel had endured a bad night, waking up screaming from a nightmare, which was unusual for him. It meant Holly also had a bad night, since Daniel then insisted on sleeping in her bed, although he didn't actually sleep much at all. On any other day, Holly might have kept him home, but Owen had an internist's appointment that morning, for which he'd been waiting weeks, and the Barhams were at a funeral in Bangor, so there was no one to take care of the boy. As a result, Daniel, subdued and heavy-lidded, had been forced to spend an unhappy day at Sabre Hill. Daniel's eyes were now fixed on the screen, but Owen could tell he was taking in little of what he was seeing. He'd tried to cajole Daniel into lying down and catching up on the shut-eye he'd missed, but he insisted on staying where he was, and every time his eyes started to close, he shifted position, as though to keep himself awake. "Hey," said Owen. Daniel looked up. "You don't need to be scared about falling asleep. I'm here, and I'm not going anywhere. I'll stay on this couch until morning if you want me to, except when I got to go pee-pee. Cause we don't want to be sitting on no pee-pee couch, do we?" Daniel didn't crack a smile. Usually even the mention of someone else's toilet habits was enough to make him bust a gut. Daniel's brow furrowed, and he asked his grandfather a question.
"Why don't I look like Mom?"
Owen assembled his features into his best poker face. "What do you mean by that?"
"What I said. Why don't I look like Mom? Her hair is real light and mine is dark."
But it was more than that, Owen knew. The boy didn't yet have the vocabulary to express the complexity of his feelings. "Because the two of you are just different is all," said Owen. "Could be you have more of your father in your appearance."
"But you said you'd never met my dad."
"I'm guessing. That's how these things sometimes are. Me, I always look more like my father than my mother. If I'd taken after my mother, I'd have been prettier." Again, no smile.
"Why doesn't Mom ever talk about my dad?"
Where was this coming from? "It makes her sad."
"Why?"
"It just does."
"Because he died?"
"Yes, because he died." Daniel's gaze shifted to the window and the woods beyond.
"Can someone have two mommies?"
"Good Lord. I guess. Your friend Dina at school, she has two moms. Her daddy remarried, and Dina goes to stay with him and his new wife twice a month. Dina gets on okay with her stepmom, right?" Daniel nodded. "So she's a second mom in a way. Is that what you mean?" This time Daniel shook his head.
"What if your mom dies?"
he asked.
"What if your mom dies and you go to live with another mom?"
Owen experienced a sense of constriction in his chest. If his left arm had gone numb and he'd keeled over from a heart attack, it wouldn't have surprised him. "What about it?"
"Is the dead mom still your mom?"
Owen was in alien territory now, lost in the boonies. There was no right answer here. He could only be honest. "Yes," he said. "She'd still be your mom." Daniel's chin trembled, and Owen gathered the boy to him and held him close as he started to sob.
"But which one is real?"
Daniel cried.
"Which one is real?"
Chapter 92. Days, even weeks, might have gone by before the remains of Garrison Pryor were discovered, had the heat alarm in his kitchen not malfunctioned, causing it to beep incessantly, disturbing Pryor's neighbors on either side, and necessitating a visit from the super. Now, a cadre of detectives and federal agents were staring down at what was left of Pryor's body, along with the various pieces that had been excised from it and placed in the bathroom sink. "Someone really didn't like him," said one of the agents. "There wasn't much of him to like," came the reply. "There's less now." They heard movement behind them and turned to see SAC Edgar Ross of the New York field office standing in the doorway. While Boston was involved in the prior investigation, the main impetus was coming from D.C. and New York, and from Ross in particular. He didn't look as though he appreciated the agent's humor, but he left it to his expression to communicate his displeasure. Finally, after an awkward minute of contemplation, he departed.
"How the fuck did he get up here so fast?" said the first agent.
His colleague shrugged.
"They say he has a place over in Cambridge."
"On a federal salary?"
"You don't know? Ross comes from money. He's not hurting. Shit, he's even a member of one of those fancy clubs."
Chapter 93. Connie White deposited into her bank account half the money given to her by Giller, spent some on wool at the local craft shop, and the remainder at Marshall's. Ordinarily, she'd have saved a little, just in case, but she'd registered the look on Giller's face when she told him about Holly Weaver's boy. The Weaver name meant something to him, which guaranteed he'd be back with more money. White had no concerns that Giller might try to screw her over. He might not have been averse to negotiation. No businessman was. But she knew from asking around that Giller kept his word once a deal was made. To do otherwise wouldn't have been good for his reputation as an honest broker. White pulled up outside her trailer, expecting to see Steeler emerge from his kennel. But there was no sign of the dog. Steeler was familiar with the sound of her car and could sometimes be as lazy as sin, but he always made an appearance to greet her. She could see his chain snaking into the kennel. It was odd, but she wasn't alarmed.
"Steeler?"
A bark came in response, not from the kennel, but from inside the trailer. Maybe Eddie, her brother, had dropped by and allowed Steeler to go in with him. She'd been asking Eddie for weeks to take a look at the seal around the oven. Although he wasn't supposed to let Steeler enter the trailer because the dog was crazy for yarn and liked nothing better than to tear apart a ball of it with tooth and claw. But Eddie was fond of Steeler, and the dog knew it.
"Shit, Eddie,"
she said as she opened the door and stepped inside.
"I've told you before about..."
An unfamiliar woman was sitting at the table, Steeler beside her, his front legs on her lap, his tail wagging. Steeler loved his mistress and liked her brother a lot, but that had always appeared to be the limit of his affection for human beings. Until now. The woman was wearing a blue plastic skull cap, the hair beneath smeared tight against it. She had the skin of a drowning victim and the eyes of a doll. Then White was no longer looking at the intruder or at Steeler, but at the gun that appeared from behind the dog's back, the threat made more real by the suppressor on the muzzle. White had seen enough movies to know that nobody put a suppressor on a gun that wasn't going to be used.
"You have a nice dog," said the woman.
White tried to run, and Moores shot her in the back. Chapter 94. Layla Patton lived on a street of identical single-story houses in a development that probably dated from the 70s. Most of the homes were in good condition, although the Pattons bore indicators of neglect suggestive of a dearth of time, money, or both. Parker pulled into the drive and got out of his car. He waited, as requested, for Patton to go inside first and make sure her mom was okay. 10 minutes went by, during which nothing stirred on the road beyond a single black cat with a dead bird in its teeth, before Parker heard the sound of a couple of windows opening at the front of the house, and Patton waved at him to enter. Although he did not comment on it, Parker could tell why she had opened the windows as soon as he reached the door. The house smelled of long-term illness, of the slow failure of the body and the steps taken to ease it. Parker heard the sound of a television from somewhere at the back of the house. A woman coughed, then was quiet. Patton was waiting for him in the living room. It was tidy in the way of rooms that are rarely used. Perhaps it was his knowledge of the family circumstances that colored his perceptions, but Parker thought it felt like a space awaiting mourners. The only incongruous detail was the piano in one corner. Parker didn't know much about pianos, but the instrument was clean and free of dust, and the surrounding carpet bore the marks of repeated repositioning of the piano stool, which suggested it wasn't just a decorative feature.
"Do you want something to drink?"
Patton asked.
"I was going to make green tea."
"Sounds good." She left him alone again. He went to the fireplace and examined the framed photographs on the mantel. A younger Layla featured in many of them, often alongside a heavy-set man who had started going bald early, tried to disguise it, and finally surrendered to the inevitable before he vanished entirely from the gallery, as though fate, not content with taking his hair, had decided to appropriate the rest of him as well. And a short, dark-haired woman who started out thin and kept getting thinner until there were no more pictures of her at all, freezing her at a stage before her illness became her most pronounced feature. Judging by how old her daughter looked in the most recent photo, Parker guessed that the final pictures of Patton's mother might have been taken 4 or 5 years earlier, perhaps about the time Karis passed through Cadillac on her way to a death in the Maine woods.
"She doesn't like to look at them."
Patton had entered the room behind him, carrying a tray with a pot of Chinese design, 2 small matching cups, and a plate of cookies that were clearly home-baked. She put the tray down on a low table before joining him at the fireplace.
"My mom, I mean. She doesn't like to be reminded of how she used to be. But I do."
Parker didn't say that he was sorry. After so many years of looking after her mother, Layla Patton had probably heard every platitude in existence. "How long can you keep caring for her at home?" he asked.
"A few more months."
She spoke matter-of-factly, but wouldn't look directly at him.
"After that, she'll need full-time attention until the end."
"Is there somewhere nearby?"
"Not really, or nowhere I'd want her to be. We'll have to sell the house to cover the expenses. But I wasn't planning on staying here anyway."
"Where will you go?"
"Eventually. Somewhere with a view. But first, Bloomington. The Jacobs School of Music, if they'll still have me. I was offered a scholarship a while back, but I couldn't accept it because of how sick my mom was. It's being held for me. Or it was. I'm almost afraid to ask now."
"Is Jacobs good?" She laughed.
"Good? Jacobs is the best in the country, even better than Berkeley or Juilliard. Although the Curtis in Philadelphia runs pretty close."
"Let me guess," said Parker. "Piano."
"I can see why you're a detective. What gave it away, I wonder?"
"The flattening to your fingertips," said Parker. Patton instinctively looked at her hands. "But mainly that big piano in the corner."
"Witty," said Patton. "Just like the detectives in books."
She poured the tea, and they ate a cookie each. Patton sat on the couch, and Parker took an armchair while he tried to explain to her why she should trust him. She listened, and when she asked questions, he did his best to answer them honestly. When he didn't want to answer, he let her know. He had no desire to lie to her. To all this, he consented because he believed the young woman before him had something she wished to share, and perhaps of which she needed to unburden herself. And even if what he learned did not aid him in his investigation, and he succeeded only in relieving her of its weight, this would be sufficient. Because sometimes the service asked of us is just to listen. Only later did Parker understand that in this room colored by dying, he had laid himself bare before a stranger, and by doing so had decreased the measure of his own pain. Parker finished talking. Layla, for she was Layla to him now, and Layla she would always remain, touched Parker's hand, and in establishing that connection, she spoke.
"Lamb,"
she said.
"That was Karis's second name. But she told me to keep it secret."
Layla got up and left the room again. When she returned, she was holding a shoebox, which she placed on the coffee table.
"Karis,"
she said,
"told me to keep lots of things secret."
Chapter 95. Quayle was waiting for Moore's when she returned. the killings of recent hours lending a temporary warmth to her pallor, as though in depriving others of life she had absorbed a little of their vigor to compensate for the paucity of her own. Quail knew her requirements by now. He had laid out a sheet of plastic just inside the door, on which Moore stood to shed her clothing until she was naked before him. Only then did she step from the plastic and carefully gather up the ends of the sheet, knotting them together to form a neat package. Later she would soak the contents in bleach before dumping. Burning them would have been preferable, but they were concerned about the smoke drawing attention to the cabin. Moore showered before dressing in fresh clothes, the smell of bleach already beginning to permeate the space. Quail, lost in thought, had still not moved from his chair by the time she was finished. Moore did not disturb him, but curled up on a couch and fell instantly asleep. Quail was very close to what he had been seeking for so long, but the temptation to bring it to an end with alacrity had to be tempered with caution. He did not wish to be the quarry in a manhunt when all this was done, or not before he had safely left this place to return to England. How soon before the bodies of Mullis, White, and the rest were found? Not long, he supposed. He had no fear that Moores might have been seen in the immediate vicinity of either the house or the trailer. She was too good for that. But one could not account for every possibility. And there was always the small chance that someone might recall an unfamiliar vehicle glimpsed on the road. It would be best if Moores abandoned her car. Giller had sourced two for them, guaranteed clean, and one would suffice for what remained to be done. Since Holly Weaver worked long hours and the boy was at school, their home stood empty for most of the day. Owen Weaver was a problem, since his own property was so close to his daughter's, but he had to go out sometime. If he didn't, they would deal with him. Nevertheless, it would be better if they could find what they wanted, take it, and vanish without leaving any more bodies behind. The greater the carnage, the greater the likelihood of being caught, and they had already ended enough lives. There had been no choice when it came to the others, but Quail could see no reason to inflict harm on the Weavers, or none beyond a vague desire for retribution, and that would be assuaged as soon as he had what he wanted. And then there was Parker to consider, because he was also searching for Karis Lamb's son. With Giller gone, there was no way of finding out how close Parker might be. But Quail had made provisions for his distraction. They might require one more body. Although, thankfully, Morse's enthusiasm for killing appeared quite inexhaustible. She really was, Quail thought, the most remarkable woman. Part 4. We all know that books burn, yet we have the greater knowledge that books cannot be killed by fire. People die, but books never die. In this war, we know, books are weapons. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 1882 to 1945. Chapter 96. The shoebox remained on the coffee table, but Layla made no move to display its contents. In Parker's opinion, she possessed an admirable sense of theater.
I liked Karis,
said Layla.
In another life, we might have been friends. But we didn't have time for that. She was here, and then she was gone.
Weren't you concerned when she left and you received no further communication from her? Parker asked.
No. She warned me that it was how it would be. How it had to be. Because of the man she was running from. And what she'd done to him.
Who was he, this man?
Karis called him Vernet. I don't know his first name. And Karis told me not to go searching for more information about him, not even on the Internet. Dobie knew more, but not much, and what he had he didn't share with me.
And did you go looking into Vernet?
Of course, but not until later. Months, maybe a year after Karis left. Inquisitiveness, you know?
And?
There were more Vernays than I'd expected. But I knew the one I wanted was a book collector, so I started browsing forums and blogs. I was careful. I set up a new email account to log on, and used only a Tor browser to make myself hard to trace. One evening, I opened my email, and there was a new message in my inbox from a no-reply address. It read, "Why are you searching for Vernay?" It came with a photograph attached, a picture of a child, a girl no more than 3 or 4 years old, naked, dead. I deleted the account and stopped looking. I think Vernay disappeared, though. There was chatter about it on some of the forums before all references to him ceased, and all the old postings were expunged, like everyone had been told to keep quiet.
You didn't share this with anyone else?
No, I'd made a mistake. I didn't want to compound my error by bringing these people to our door.
Parker thought Layla Patton was quite something. What did Karis tell you about her time with Vernay? He asked.
Not a lot. He started out gentle, she said. That's what Karis couldn't understand. She felt stupid. But she wouldn't be the first woman to have been fooled by a man. By the time she found out what he was really like, the pornography, how he enjoyed watching children being hurt, it was too late. She was pregnant, and he wouldn't let her out of his sight. She was certain he'd kill her once the baby was born. He never threatened her that way, but she knew. It was the child he wanted. And he had this weird taste in books. Occult stuff. Not novels or stories, but old volumes. Grimoire, they're called. He told Karis he knew more about them than anyone else in the country, perhaps even the world. He would receive mail from all over, addressed only to M. Vernay, and men would come and visit him because he was such an expert. But they weren't the type to help a pregnant woman. They were the kind that shared Vernay's interests, and not just in mysticism. They would view films together on a screen in Vernay's library, and exchange electronic files containing images of torture. They liked pain. By that point, Vernay didn't care what Karis did or didn't know about his tastes. He was done pretending. Then, in her final trimester, she detected a change in him. He was excited. He started selling parts of his collection, trying to bring in money. Karis thought negotiations might be taking place in the background, because there were phone calls and arguments. Finally, Vernay locked her in the basement and left her there. Karis had food and water, some books and magazines, and a little bathroom for her needs. She was trapped for 2 days and 2 nights, and when Vernay returned, he had another book. That was why he had shut her up in the basement, so he could go buy a book, a collection of fairy tales.
Fairy tales? Said Parker.
Grimm's Fairy Tales, printed in London in 1908 by Constable, with illustrations by Arthur Rackham. The original Rackham edition is very valuable. Some copies go for $1,000 or more on the Internet. There's also a signed edition, and that goes for more than $10,000.
And was this one signed?
No.
Wait. He locked Karis Lamb in a basement for 2 days, just to possess a book of fairy tales worth $1,000?
A guy in England was killed for his first edition of The Wind in the Willows,
said Layla.
It was worth nearly $70,000.
There's a big difference between $1,000 and $70,000.
Especially,
said Layla,
for a book that doesn't exist.
Parker felt as though he'd fallen down a rabbit hole. I don't understand.
There is no 1908 Grimm's Fairy Tales illustrated by Arthur Rackham. The edition illustrated by Rackham wasn't published until the following year.
So the book was a forgery?
No. Or so Vernay told Karis. He wanted an audience, and she was the only one he had. He wanted someone to know what he'd found.
So what exactly did Vernay buy? Layla pushed the shoebox toward Parker.
Why don't you take a look for yourself?
Chapter 97. Holly Weaver received the call from her father as she was waiting at the drive-through ATM. Her bank account was about to dip into three figures, but at least she was due to get paid on Friday, and with luck she'd score some decent tips over the weekend, especially if she could get a couple of tables to spring for wine.
Hi, Dad.
I'm thinking of taking Danny to a movie, see if it might buck his mood up.
Sure? Did he nap?
He dozed on the couch for a while, but he's still not himself.
It's just tiredness.
Yeah. She heard the doubt.
Did something else happen?
Owen thought about telling her of the conversation he'd had with Daniel, the one about dead mothers, but decided to keep it to himself for now. It would only distress his daughter.
He's just an odd one sometimes.
I think he picked it up from his grandfather,
said Holly. Yeah? Then his back talk is all you.
Enjoy the movie, Dad. Easy on the popcorn and keep the sodas small.
Daniel sat at his bedroom window. Daylight was fading into dusk and a haze hung over the woods, but he thought he could still discern the figure of a woman amid the trees. If he opened the window, he might even have been able to hear her call his name. But he had no intention of opening the window.
Is she telling the truth?
Said Daniel. He spoke to the girl in the corner, the one who kept her head low and seemed to bring shadows with her in order to conceal her face. Daniel should have been frightened of her, just as he was frightened of the woman, because the girl, too, was dead. Except she didn't make him feel scared, just drowsy and relaxed, like the cough medicine his mom sometimes gave him when his chest got tight. He could see the girl's reflection in the glass, but when he looked over his shoulder, she wasn't there.
What did she tell you?
That I should do what Mommy said. That I should listen to her.
She's not your mommy.
She says she is.
Sometimes when people die, they leave a piece of themselves behind.
What kind of piece?
A sad piece, but it's not really them, only their pain.
She comes to my window.
She's lonely.
She wants me to go with her.
You mustn't do that.
She might make me.
She can't make you. You have to want it. Do you want it?
No, I just want her to go away.
She will.
When?
Soon.
How do you know?
Because she is about to be named, and she will rest after she is named.
Who will name her?
The girl didn't answer at first. Then...
Perhaps my father will name her.
Daniel looked from the girl's reflection to the waiting woman.
Can you ask him to hurry?
Chapter 98. Parker picked up the shoebox. It had clearly remained untouched for a long time because Layla Patton's fingerprints had disturbed the dust on it. He lifted the lid. The book lay amid wads of newspaper, the boards worn at the corners and slightly stained. What did Vernet tell Karis? Parker asked.
He said the book itself wasn't important, just the pages in it. He said they had altered the volume and changed the date, because that's what they did. They were part of an atlas, he said, one that was old and enduring. He claimed the pages could rewrite.
Rewrite books?
Rewrite worlds. Be careful how you touch it.
Is it delicate?
No, but it can make you feel sick. Let me find some gloves for you.
She returned with a pair of leather gloves. They were too small for Parker's hands, but he managed to get his fingers partway into them. He removed the book from the box and examined the exterior before proceeding to the contents. A bookplate was fixed to the inside front cover, featuring the letter D repeated twice and the word London beneath. The addition of the location was odd. and more indicative of a store or lending library than a private collection. Parker moved on to the first of the places where the pages were different. A larger single sheet, much older than the rest of the book, had at some point been folded twice and sewn into the binding between two other sections. The visible sides were blank, and made not from paper, but what appeared to be some form of vellum, uncut at the top edges. He moved to the second insertion and discovered the same. Very gently, Parker lifted one of the pages in an effort to see what was written on the interior of the folds. They were also unmarked. Why, Parker wondered, would someone go to the trouble of inserting blank pages into a volume? Unless, of course, they weren't really blank at all. He tried to recall the ways in which invisible ink could be applied. Lemon juice, wine, vinegar, sugar solution, bodily fluids, their message to be revealed later by the application of heat or chemicals. Empty, he said.
Not always.
What do you mean?
Sometimes, if I leave the book open for long enough, I see patterns.
What kind of patterns?
It'll sound crazy.
Not to me. Layla took a deep breath.
Okay. Not patterns, but the ghosts of them. Sometimes they're like maps, and other times they're closer to architect's drawings, but really detailed?
That fit with Parker's thesis, an ink of some kind activated by heat or light. Drawings of what?
Of the book's surroundings, of the room it's in. This room, for example.
Wait, they change?
I told you it would sound crazy.
Sounding crazy isn't the same thing as being crazy.
It's close enough.
I guess it is. Parker turned to the copyright page of the book. There, as Layla had said, was the date, 1908. A printer's error? Wasn't that the kind of detail that made a book more valuable?
Look at the text, said Layla.
Parker did as she asked, and noticed that some words, and even the individual letters within them, were so jumbled as to render the stories unintelligible, as though a catastrophic error had been made during the setting process.
If you look at them again tomorrow, they could be different,
said Layla. Different how?
The letters may have rearranged themselves again. Look long enough, and you'll begin seeing messages. I thought it was kind of cool at first. Freaky, but cool. Until they formed the words, "Look away, cunt," on page 14. I stopped opening the book after that.
She bit at a thumbnail.
And then there are the illustrations.
Chapter 99. Billy Ocean hadn't been in Hoagie's in a long time, not since he was old enough to drink legally. Hoagie's was one of those bars where the lights were always low, the music always loud, and people tended to mind their own business unless forced to do otherwise, which was rarely the case. It lay between Harmony and Corinna in southern Somerset County, and attracted little passing trade due to the unprepossessing nature of its exterior, which was matched by the unprepossessing nature of its interior, and its restrooms in particular, which were notoriously insalubrious. But a Bud Light and Hoagie's was $1.50 all day, and the food wasn't so bad if you didn't let it linger in your mouth. Billy found Quail sitting at a table away from the bar, a glass of clear liquor before him. Billy identified him by his dress sense. It was possible that someone else had previously worn a velvet vest and knitted silk tie in Hoagie's, but if so, it was far enough in the past for the trauma to have faded from the bar's collective memory. Quail didn't look like he belonged in Hoagie's, but neither did he appear particularly uncomfortable in its surroundings. Some people had a way of colonizing spaces, adapting them to form sanctuaries for themselves. Quail was such a man. Billy took a seat at the table, and a waitress came by for his order. He noticed that she barely registered Quayle's presence, and even when she did, her gaze slid from him like water from an oiled boot. Whatever vibes he was giving off, they weren't good.
"So you're British?" said Billy.
"I think of myself as English first, British second. It's a way of keeping the Scots and Welsh at a distance, never mind the Irish."
Billy was confused, but didn't care enough one way or the other to seek further clarification.
"What are you doing over here?"
"I'm holidaying."
"You're on vacation?"
"If you prefer."
Again, Billy didn't really give a fuck.
"So," Billy said once his beer had arrived, "who blew up my truck?"
"A man named Charlie Parker. He's a private investigator."
Billy consumed this information with a mouthful of beer.
"I know who he is. And you figure this how?"
"Because it's common knowledge, or relatively so. The police are aware, and I believe your father is too. But the police won't do anything about it, because they have no proof. And there also appears to be a don't-touch rule when it comes to Parker. As for your father, well, I can't say. Perhaps he's concerned you might be tempted to do something foolish and put yourself at risk as a consequence."
"Why did Parker pick on me?"
"Pick on. What an interesting choice of words," Quayle thought.
They told him all he needed to know about the man sitting opposite.
"He keeps company with a colored man named Louis. My understanding is that this Louis found certain aspects of your truck's decor objectionable, and Parker assisted him in registering what was, all things considered, a forceful protest."
Billy stood.
"I need to make a call," he said.
He went outside and called Dean Harper, his father's former aide. They hadn't spoken since Harper's firing, but Billy was less fearful of Harper when he didn't have to face him in person.
"What do you want?" Harper asked when Billy identified himself. "To get you your job back? Least you can fucking do, seeing as how you lost it for me. My old man misses you."
This was true. Billy's father regretted letting Harper go, but he didn't like backtracking on a decision. He thought it made him seem weak. For Harper, though, he might be persuaded to make an exception.
"It won't take much to talk him around. And you're doing this out of the goodness of your heart? It's by way of an apology. I only want a word in return. What word would that be? Yes or no? And the question? My truck. Was Charlie Parker the name you heard?"
No reply. Or not the one he wanted.
"Jesus, Billy," said Harper. "You gotta let this go." "You want that job back, or don't you?" "Sure I do." "Then answer the question." "Yes. The answer is yes, but Billy..."
Billy didn't wait to hear the rest. He killed the connection and went back inside to rejoin Quayle.
"Seeking confirmation,"
said Quayle as Billy sat down.
"Maybe."
"It's always advisable to secure a second opinion. And what did you learn?"
"That you might be telling the truth."
"That I am telling the truth."
"Okay, yeah, so you are. What do you want in return? Money?"
"No. I just want to help you retaliate."
"Why would you do that?"
"Because Parker is in my way, and I'd like to see him distracted."
"Getting in the way of your, vacation?"
"That's right. I'm also prepared to compensate you for your time. You can put the money toward a new truck. Perhaps one with a more subdued sense of ornamentation."
Billy grinned.
"Seems to me that you might be up to no good here. Are you a bad man?"
Quayle smiled back, and the lights of the bar gleamed like dying stars in the void of his eyes.
"Trust me when I say that you have no conception."
Billy's smile faded.
"What kind of retaliation did you have in mind?" he asked.
Parker took something from you that you valued. I suggest you do the same to him. A little bird told me that he owns a vintage Mustang. He's very fond of it. Why not burn it?
Billy knew the car. He'd seen it around town. Burning it seemed like a very good idea. It wasn't worth as much as his truck, but Billy was prepared to make allowances for sentimental value.
I have a friend outside, said Quail. She's quite an expert at destruction. Why don't I introduce you to her? After all, no time like the present.
Chapter 100. Layla Patton powered up her laptop.
Look, she said, these are some of Rackham's original illustrations for the 1909 edition.
They were not what Parker had anticipated. He was, he supposed, more familiar with the pictures that featured in young children's collections of fairy tales, with their bright primary colors, their knights on horseback, and wolves in bonnets. Rackham's work bore no relation to that tradition beyond the thematic. Here the colors were muted, the characters sensual, and an ambiance of the ethereal, the sinister, infused all, particularly the depictions of forests and trees, their trunks like hides, their branches the limbs of grasping, emaciated creatures.
Impressive, right? said Layla.
They're beautiful. Unsettling, but beautiful.
You haven't even started being unsettled yet.
She pulled up a Rackham illustration from the tale of Snow White and Rose Red, in which the two young women of the title stood beside a great fallen tree with twisted exposed roots, facing a dwarf trapped by the weight of the trunk. The rendering of the scene reminded Parker of Caris Lamb's gravesite.
Okay,
said Layla.
You should be able to find the equivalent illustration in the book.
Parker flipped through it until he found the correct plate. I've got it.
Now compare it to the one on the screen.
He did. They appeared similar, apart from a slight blemish to the background of the plate in the book, where Rackham had faded the forest into darkness. They look alike.
Hold on.
Layla went to a closet beside the piano and removed a magnifying glass from one of the drawers. Parker suddenly felt very old. Apparently, he now needed a magnifying glass to identify what a 20-something could see with the naked eye. His despair obviously showed on his face, because Layla told him not to feel too bad.
I had trouble spotting some of them at the start. And they also change. Like I said, it's been a while since I opened the book.
Parker took the glass and held it over the blemish. Staring back at him from the depths of the forest was the mutilated child glimpsed back in Portland. Its face was half hidden, and only a suggestion of its body was visible in the murk. But it was the same figure.
I've checked so many versions of the plate on the internet,
said Layla.
That thing is not in any of the others. Only this one.
Parker looked at the illustration again. It seemed that more of the child was visible now. He could see its head more clearly, and part of its right leg. Except its position had altered, and it was now closer to the fallen tree before it. Layla was watching him.
You can say it,
she said. It gives the impression of movement.
That's a very non-committal way of putting it.
It could be that I find the alternative unappealing. Layla took the glass from him and used it to peer at the plate, although she remained careful not to touch the book itself. Parker regarded the figure once more before turning the page and hiding it from view. And you never discussed this with anyone else? He said. You never felt the urge to seek help?
With what? The illustrations in a book? I don't think you can dial 911 for a literary emergency.
She was smiling, but Parker could tell she was close to tears. The secrets she'd kept hidden were slowly being revealed, and the effect was like lancing a boil.
And I've been scared for so long. I was afraid I was going insane, and that was bad. But then I realized I wasn't, which was worse. I wish I'd never agreed to keep the book.
Why did you?
Because Kara said that if Vernay managed to track her down, she didn't want him to get everything. I think she hoped the book might be a way of bargaining if worst came to worst. You know, it would be returned to Vernay if he let Karis and the baby go. And because I thought it was just a book, an ordinary book, it didn't matter what some child fucker believed. It was a collection of fairy tales with a couple of extra pages sewn in, and they were blank. If having it stolen screwed up his life, then good. But to be safe, Karis also asked Dobie to find her a decoy copy. She didn't put it that way, and she didn't tell him why she wanted it. She just needed him to track down a similar edition, and quickly, so he did. I remember it was couriered overnight. He cut some deal for it, but it was still expensive. Karis paid, though. She insisted on it.
And she took the decoy with her when she left Cadillac?
Yes, although Dobie thought she took both versions. He would never have agreed to my holding on to the original, and I don't think he'd have wanted to hold on to it himself, either. But then he knew more about Vernay than I did.
Parker was turning the pages of the book before him while Layla spoke. Does every plate contain an extra element?
Most of them.
Show me. Layla did. She had to take a break to help her mother to the bathroom, and afterward to prepare a fresh pot of tea. But by the end, Parker was under no illusions about the strangeness of the book. Hidden among Rackham's illustrations were hybrid beings reminiscent of the nightmares tempting St. Anthony in the works of Grunewald and Rosa, of the tormentors in Signorelli's Damned Cast into Hell, of the haunters in Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights. And as the intruders in the plates took form beneath the magnifier, Parker began to feel this might be no coincidence, and that these earlier artists had stumbled upon elemental images buried deep in the human consciousness, a shared memory of that which might seek to hunt us in the final darkness, a glimpse of all that observed humanity from behind the glass, waiting to devour. But the beasts that moved through the pages of the book in Parker's hands were more imminent than any visions captured by artists. They were not simulacra, but neither were they real. Rather, they represented the potential usurpation of one reality, its slow infection by another. Parker was very glad Layla Patton had given him gloves with which to hold the book. He also believed she was wise to have hidden it away and not to have looked at it too often. To expose oneself to it was to risk contamination, and ultimately, perhaps, one's own corruption. But the book held one more surprise for Parker, and an unwelcome one. The illustration accompanying the white snake showed a servant in conversation with a fish, a forest of white birch as the backdrop. From among the trees, a blurred face of yellow and black stared out at them.
That's new, said Layla. What's wrong with its face?
Parker positioned the magnifying glass, but already he had a premonition of the answer. It was a head formed entirely of insects. Wasps, said Parker, and the god of wasps appeared to blink. In the garden of her grandparents' home, Sam spoke to Jennifer.
What is Daddy searching for?
The child.
No, there's more.
What do you see?
Stories. Something old in the shape of a man, but empty inside. A child, but not a child.
Jennifer raised a hand and flicked it at the air, as though to brush away the unwanted attention of an insect.
And wasps.
The book was closed once again, the figures within now concealed, and those without protected from their gaze.
What is the god of wasps?
Layla asked. Some call it the one who waits behind the glass, Parker replied. To others, it's the buried god. Are you religious?